Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Tanya the Communication Doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do. Hello, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Tanya the Communication Doctor. And I'm really happy to have Marsha Manroop and Farah Havish on the show today. Now, before I start, I just want to let my audience know this is a different podcast today, because in tribute of George Floyd. Now, I'm going to take a passage from a newspaper article that I read quite recently, which was sent to me via social media, and I was tagging it via Farah Harris. And I'm just going to start that first of all and just talk through the perspective of the Black person's emotions and feelings during this time of the George Floyd episode. Okay, so over the last few months, Black people have not only watched their friends and family members die at higher rates from coronavirus, they have also watched people who look like them be gunned down while going for a jog, be murdered in their homes, threatened while bird watching in Central Park, and mercilessly choked on camera. So the first thing, as I just bring in Marsha and bring in Farah, I just want to go straight in. I want to dive straight in. First of all, Marsha, do you want to introduce yourself? And Farah, do you want to introduce yourself? So Marsha, first of all.
Hi, I'm Marsha Manroop, and I am the founder director of Unheard Voice Consultancy Limited, which is a diversity and inclusion consultancy, which focuses strategies and solutions based on cultural intelligence.
Brilliant. And Farah, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Farah Harris, and I am a licensed professional counselor, and I'm the owner of Working Well Daily, a company that is focused on helping individuals create better work-life alignment and corporate wellness.
You know what, it's so great to have you ladies on the show today, and it's an amazing lineup. So just as human beings, I want you to answer the question. After hearing the news of George Floyd and seeing how the world around us has reacted, how did it make you feel? Let's start with Farah.
Sadly, his death hasn't been the first. So with social media being what it is, the video and the photo of the police officer with his knee on his neck was the first thing that I saw, and immediately knew I had to guard myself, guard my, I guess, my eye gate for the assault on my person, the assault on my spirit, because it was right after the Amy Cooper situation where a white woman was trying to weaponize a Black man by saying that she would call the police, but specifically identified him as an African-American and used the term, you know, as a threat, because she was inciting pretty much harm. And, you know, thankfully nothing happened, but within 24 hours, then we see the story of George Floyd, and it could have been the same unfortunate outcome for the Central Park case with Amy Cooper and Christian Cooper. And so I think initially it was just like, here we go again. But it just felt different. I think it felt different because this wasn't a murder by weapon, if you understand what I'm saying. It wasn't watching someone get gunned down. We were watching a human being using their body to kill another human being, and it was just so heartbreaking.
Yeah, no, I totally understand and felt similar myself. What about you, Marsha? Just your feelings on it, first of all, just to open.
I felt very saddened, but at the same time, I was also really surprised by the reaction that it was getting, because just like Farah said, this is not new. This has been happening over and over and over again with, you know, chokeholds and as well as shootings in the US, and black people in the UK certainly have been feeling the same way about Black Lives Mattering before George Floyd. So the thing that I was most surprised by was how suddenly people were seeing this particular death as a racist incident, rather than, you know, heavy-handedness by an individual policeman or so on. And I didn't know what to say at first, because I know, as a person who's not Black, I'm a person of colour, but I'm not Black. I don't know anyone who's had that kind of treatment directly. And I feel like this really is a moment to be talking about Black lives rather than necessarily anti-racism generally. And I really needed to stop and think, how am I complicit as someone who looks like me, maybe even socialized as white? How do I need to react to this in a way that is in solidarity with Black people, but also recognizing that I'm not actually the problem, that there is a bigger thing here around Black people in white spaces and how white people need to recognize what needs to change in order for this system of racism to be brought down. So those were my initial feelings. They were very complex around, you know, being really sad and upset, feeling that actually this isn't about my experience. This is very specific to Black people. And how do I bring the conversation to whiteness and what needs to be done there?
You know, that's really strong, Farah, and really strong, Marsha. I'm going to be totally raw in saying, when I heard of the incident with regards to George Floyd, I couldn't watch the majority of it because it sickened me. And what sickened me was just to see a human being kind of, you know, that restraint and the body weight. It was just ugly to me, you know, totally ugly, totally unjust. And I was angry for at least 3 or 4 days. I'm still a little bit angry now, which is probably why I'm doing this podcast, but I had to turn that anger into positivity to feel like, what can I do to speak out and to address this situation? Because I felt powerless. And a lot of the time when you hear about these situations, you do feel powerless. So that's kind of how I felt on the situation. And as you both said, it's not the first time. The incident reminded me of Rashaun Charles, who basically was in Dalston here, and he was restrained by a police officer and choked to death. The power of social media has allowed people to see the injustice on camera and to see what happens daily. And I know it's interesting, it's so lovely to have Farah and have Marsha here today, because what's lovely is we're both talking about this from different parts of the world. And I do feel it's a slightly different experience being in America than being here in London. But racism is racism at the end of the day. And the thing that got me, and the reason I use this message, because we show up all the time. We do keep showing up. I was angry, but yet I had to show up. And when Farah put this article out on social media, it really hit me because I thought, you know what? I am angry and I am smiling. I am showing up in the workplace. And it's having to put on that constant resilience. And I do feel as Black people, we have to constantly be resilient. It's within our DNA. So how do you feel about the strength to keep showing up when everything inside of us is blowing up? How do you feel about that, Farah?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I think I was talking to my husband this weekend, and you know, you stop and you think about the history of Black people in the diaspora, but specifically Black people who are here in the United States, and the history of, as you used the word, resiliency. And it's just kind of almost mind-boggling because of everything that Black people have experienced. You wonder where we get the strength to show up. You know, where does that come from? And I think sometimes it's almost like a double-edged sword to have this strength. I think we already wrestle with the white people who view us as less than human. So we are dehumanized in one way, but then almost having the superpower of resiliency also can have this air of dehumanization, because it's like we're now above, you know, just a normal human being. We're abnormal because of this resiliency. It's a beautiful thing. I'm grateful for it, but it is also a burden in the blessing of being this way. And so, you know, I go like, we still carry on. We still make things happen. We still persevere, and that's awesome, but it's tiring.
Yes. Yes. Very much so. Go ahead, Marcia.
I think from my point of view, that's fundamental to the issue, isn't it? That I'm going to specifically talk in my observations of Black people, that you do show up and you do the work, and you have to just imagine if you were allowed to be 100% yourself, how much more amazing, how much more energy you'd be able to put into doing all the amazing things that you're trying to achieve anyway. And right. I find it so frustrating. That actually you do have to show up and not be your true selves, that I have to show up and not be my true self, that there's always something that you're presenting in a certain way. And this is the fundamental issue, and this is why, yes, people are showing up, but they shouldn't have to. You know, this is heartbreaking, absolutely devastating. Rips your soul apart to see something like that, and to have to show up and smile and carry on, and for bosses or organizations, you know, to post whatever they want to post on social media but not be there for you when you need to have that acknowledgement and be seen, that what's happened there is hurting you, and that your boss and your organization is not supporting you to be yourself and acknowledge that. That's outrageous, actually.
Yes.
It's outrageous. Mm-hmm. And to have to find the strength to keep showing up. Yeah, we keep digging and digging and digging deeper, but that has an impact. And I know, Fari, you know, with your background, you would see this. It has an impact, and that's why. This is going to have repercussions for people's mental health. Honestly, I know it's happening now anyway. Mm. I don't know whether the fact that actually we're trying to push that conversation more is going to make a difference to being able to say, I'm feeling this way because the way you perceive the color of my skin and the way that this is being played out in a social arena is hurting me. And what I need you to do is to see that and to understand that and to be different. It's people shouldn't have to find the strength. We, our white colleagues and our white organizations need to understand that we're not feeling, that we can't find the strength right now.
Totally. And it's just interesting because constantly having to put that face on, it does, or it can lead to mental health issues because it is hard to constantly keep showing up but not have the time to take out and actually just process what's going on and take it all in. And I feel that in some ways organizations are waking up, and this movement and the fact that George Floyd episode was on social media, I feel it actually has been quite powerful in terms of people seeing the racism. And the other one was the Amy Cooper, because that got me even more, because how she just used her white privilege to, you know, to try and take this black guy, you know, to get him arrested, and God knows what would have happened if it wasn't for someone that was videoing it. You know, what would have happened if it was different? But the fact that she knows that she can do this, there's a certain type of hierarchy. And how do we eliminate that? How do we get rid of this? What do we need to do? I know it might sound like a really silly question, but I have to ask that question. What do we need to do? Farah?
Yeah, it's not a silly question, because I think it's the proverbial question that we've been asking for generations. That you said hierarchy, it's a mental hierarchy. It's not a real hierarchy. We've created within our society who's better, who's worthy, who's less than. But we are all equal. And I think the conversation that is happening, I think there is a reason to have righteous anger, but we have to be purposeful with it. So I'm glad you're having this conversation on your podcast, and I hope that all of us who are gifted in whatever areas we're gifted in, we use that to make change and to bring a kind of reckoning to what's going on in this world. And so companies in particular who are being neglectful, or have been neglectful in the past of being aware of how Black people show up at work. You know, the Amy Cooper and the George Floyd are bringing up some awareness. And so I almost laugh at the fact that there are people who say that they are champions of diversity and inclusion, but are quiet, you know, in the midst of all of this. Yes. And companies who are like, yes, this is what we stand for, this is what our culture is about, but yet we're not hearing anything from the CEOs or from leaders or from managers. And, you know, along with the work that I do, you know, on the individual level for therapy, the corporate work that I do is not only to address mental health issues and how it impacts the workplace, but how emotional intelligence impacts the workplace. And one of the bedrocks, one of the greatest skill sets of having someone with high emotional intelligence is empathy.
Yes.
So I'm sitting here just kind of, you know, almost like guffaw at the whole idea of like you believing that you have any type of emotional intelligence and yet cannot empathize with your Black brothers and sisters. Mm. I don't care how much training you've done. if you can't do the basic thing of being able to look at your other person, another person, and step into their shoes and feel how they feel, to acknowledge how this current event and all the events that have happened prior can impact the ones that work with you, the ones that serve with you. No, you don't have emotional intelligence.
Gosh, that is so powerful, Farah. So, so true. It's a key. We do all this training, like you say, of inclusion, diversity training, emotional intelligence training. And it's just like reading a book, isn't it? Or doing those self-help, reading a self-help book. You know, you could read a self-help book, but if you don't implement what's in it, what's the point? You know, it doesn't make
it inauthentic.
Yeah, no, totally, totally, totally. What do you feel, Marsha?
I think that you asked the question, what should we do about it? And I think we need to stop looking at ourselves to provide the answer. I think that this work really does need to be done by white people and the white community to look at themselves. I mean, I like to sort of not misquote but paraphrase Robin DiAngelo in the introduction of her book White Fragility. She talks about how if it were up to women to have won the right to vote on their own, they would have done it. But they needed men to get on board and to support that to happen.
Yes.
And it's like racism, like black people didn't create racism. Mm-hmm. So how can we be part, how are we the solution? Yes. White people have to recognize they've created this system which keeps them in the position that they're in, that has been perpetuated in ideological, structural and institutional ways in every single part of our lives, and that this is played out not always in an intentional individual way, but in a very systematic way which ultimately results in someone, a white policeman's knee on a black man's neck.
Yes.
And that's just one example. But it's their systems, it's their ideologies, it's their thought processes, it's their institutions, it's their books, it's their history.
Yes.
That means that we're in this position right now. And we can tell you, look at that book and open up. But I use the four capabilities of cultural intelligence. The first one is drive. You've got to be motivated. You've got to want to look at this stuff. You've got to want to do it. It's like doing any kind of exercise. You can't just run a marathon tomorrow. You've got to want to get up and start to do it. And then you've got to find out what you need to know. What do you need to know? And that is going out and doing info yourself. It's just not turning to the next person you see and saying, who's of color, and saying, tell me about your experience. Because that person might not want to talk. You know, and they may not be trained to, and you know, whatever it is. Yeah. And then strategize, plan what you're going to do, think about it, reflect on it, check your biases, your own assumptions, and then have the conversation with the right person at the right time, having done that. And then it's a virtuous circle. You keep building and learning, but you've got to want to do it in the first place. Otherwise, but it's very much, I have to say, that we're talking about, this isn't a black people problem, it's an all people problem. Well, it's only a black people problem, and it's only a person of color problem, because we're suffering here.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's white people who need to do the work. And I'm not going to absolve myself here. I think those of us who socialized as white, we don't recognize our own privilege. We need to do the work as well. But it starts if you're taught correctly in school in the first place.
Yeah, you're right. And it does start with school. I mean, I think you've got two things here, really, with regards to racism anyway. You've got the government and you've got the media. And both manipulate, you know. And I feel I can say that today because it's on my podcast. you know, but, you know, if I was working for any other company, I probably wouldn't be able to say that. But I can openly say it today because I feel truly authentic to do so, because the government and the media manipulates society, and people are like sheep and they just follow. So it's a responsibility that starts at the top. But if it doesn't start at the top, we as individuals have just got to speak out and use our power of social media. And what I have liked is I have seen so many people, even today with the Blackout Tuesday, people posting Black Lives Matter, who are white, Asian, you know, people of all colours. And that, I think, is really, really, really powerful. And I think you're right in saying, Marsha, that it isn't for Black people to deal with. It is for white people to deal with, because it was caused by them. A lot of this racism, the government, and it is the government, and it is media that has caused this. And people have followed, and then you have leaders. But if you are a leader of any kind, or you own your own company, or you are an influencer, I think now's the time for you to speak out. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing today. So thank you guys for that. Thank you guys for that, because, you know, it is so important. I mean, nothing I was going to say is, what's really hard is it goes so deep, because white people see the police as their protectors, and Black people see the police as a threat. And that's kind of inbred almost because of the experience. I think it's probably hard to speak to any Black man and ask him, have you ever been stopped by the police? Because the majority of the Black men I know have been stopped by the police. And I tell you, it's known Black men, from educated Black men, from CEOs, from Black men that drive a Porsche. There's a guy I know who drives a Porsche. He's a CEO of his own company, and he's constantly stopped because he drives a Porsche, you know? No criminal record, but it's constant. And what can we do to change that? There's so much there, isn't there, really? There's so much there. What do you guys think of that with regards to the police and with regards to what I said with regards to government and the media? What's your feelings? We'll start with Marsha.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if you saw what Chris Rock tweeted. It was quite a nice little sort of summary of the situation, where he essentially said there's some professions where you just can't have bad apples. Mm. And the policing is one of those, that if, for example, American Airlines said, oh, you know, we've just got some bad apples among our pilots. Some of them land straight, but the rest crash into mountains. You know, that no one would stand for that. And policing is where one of those areas where he said you can't have bad apples. That everyone's got to be good. Yeah. And I think again, this goes back to the structural and institutional nature of some of our police forces, and you know the historic nature of that. And the fact that, you know, to refer to analogy that was used for the British National Health Service, talking about the snowy white peaks, because it's white leadership, yes. That these ideologies and these thoughts and these processes and these structures, that's where the issue arises. So with the media, with government, with policing, it's all the same issue. And it goes back to... there is only so much we can point people in the right direction, but they have to go and then do the work. And so it's about white leadership right now, looking in the mirror and saying, I want to make this change because I want to understand. For example, last year, the UN Human Rights Special Rapporteur on Racism, she wrote this of the UK, that work remains to be done to address structural forms of racial discrimination and inequality. All over the UK, persons belonging to racial and ethnic minorities have poorer outcomes in many areas of life. And that's the UNHR Special Rapporteur on Racism who said that about the UK. Right. And I think that, you know, it's recognised that there are structural issues to play in government. Mm. And because that the government sits over sort of all the other estates that feed into, whether it's religious ones as well, into the way that certainly the UK is structured, it's from that point that things need to change.
Yeah, totally. No, I totally agree with you. And it just makes what comes to my mind, I'm just thinking now, you know, because look, with regards to social media being so powerful, are things going to change, or are things going to transfer like they are in this country, in Europe, where things are just done behind closed doors? And that is my question. And I know it may sound negative, but, you know, when Stephen Lawrence died, when Damiola Taylor died, all of these racial acts, one after the other, you always think there's going to be change. Mm-hmm. And there's not. And in some ways, it's interesting with statistics, but in some ways, part of me wants to be positive about this. But part of me is also losing help. And I feel that heavy burden as well that you talked about, Farah, in terms of needing to pass that on, really, to move forward. And it's just interesting. What's your feelings, Farah?
I 100% agree with Marcia. And I'm glad that you said at the end, even religious structures. It is a white problem. Mm. It's not a race problem. It's a white problem. Mm. And, you know, when we look at all the systems, when we understand even the origins of how policing happened within this country in the United States, you know, it wasn't to create law and order, so to speak. It was is to check on the slaves and the those that they still considered slaves mentally, the white people who still viewed black people as slaves, even though we were quote unquote free. Mm-hmm. You know, but then, you know, one of the things that I had posted about last week, before I took a break off of social media, because yes, I agree, the media, the government, everyone has a narrative that they're trying to put out there. And I didn't want to listen to the narrative anymore. So for my own mental health, yes, I removed myself from social media for several days. But before I went off, I was challenging my white Christian brothers and sisters and, you know, asking, has the conversation of race been brought up, you know, at the pulpit? And if it hasn't been before, why not? And with the current events, would they be looking for their white pastor to acknowledge what was going on? And if they didn't, then what does that mean? Mm. And so it's a top down, and it's a vertical and it's a horizontal issue amongst white people. And I think that's the part that is just shameful, really, that we as black people and other people of color get assaulted in every system, you know, so we can get assaulted at work with the racism, the microaggressions, the being unseen. And then we think we go to a safe place of worship and the same assault happens there.
You know what? What stuck in my mind of what you said, Farah, and I don't know if you're going to like this, but it's interesting when you called out, you know, your Christian brothers and sisters who were white and asked them, you know, what is being said? How do I say this? Whenever I think of Christianity, I think of how the Christian or the white Christians used Christianity to control in terms of history. Yeah, to control black people. Mm-hmm. And it goes
extreme back. Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. So it's and it's interesting. It kind of just brings that back. It was used to control us. Mm-hmm. And I don't really talk about two things, and that's religion and politics. And now I'm kind of breaking all of my rules here. but I do have a strong feeling about that in terms of how Christianity has been used by the was brought to Africa by the missionaries. And it was used to control us, and it controlled us kind of through slavery. And it even now is still controlling. And it's just really interesting how that is now playing out, or maybe played out, but we just have to reverse it. It's almost like being a magician now, isn't it, really? Having to just turn everything around and look at it, use the religion in a positive way, because religion can be used in a positive and a negative way. I suppose moving forward, I mean, the reason I ask that question is because I've been asking those questions time and time again. What can we do? How can we make change? And is it the fact that people have seen George Floyd and it's gone viral on social media? is it now that people are now going to think about change and people are going to do something? I feel a lot's been done, but how long is this going to last? And how's this going to impact us as people in terms of the white privilege as well? Because I have people saying to me, Tanya, I understand, or I'm trying to understand, or I don't understand, but I want to understand. Yeah. And then people are recognizing their white privilege, which is the first step of awareness. But then I don't want it to take, then it turns into this hierarchy thing. And so I'm confused. Yeah, I'm going to put it out there. I'm confused as to what's happening right now. How is this? Because I'm wondering, how is this going to play out in the future? Is there going to be change? Because for me, people have been talking about change for centuries, but is there going to be change? So all I must feel right now myself as I'm doing this podcast is I've got to have hope that there is going to be change, just like Martin Luther King had hope, but he was assassinated, you know, but at the same time... See, my brain's doing that. It's like, okay, he's had hope. This has happened. This is how
gymnastics.
It is. And it's very, very difficult. But at the same time, if you don't have hope, then you'll just have fear. So hope's better than fear, right?
Fear or anger. Yeah. But I think to what Marcia had said earlier, you know, this is, no pun intended, a race for white people. To, you know, you don't just go, I'm going to do a marathon or I'm going to go, do some great endeavor. You start off with the self-awareness and the conviction to want to do something. And so we are hoping, to your point, that people are being convicted, white people are being convicted. Mm. And when you are convicted, you know, throwing back a little bit of religion or spirituality, when you're convicted, it is to bring about change and for you to have correction.
Yes.
Even if it's uncomfortable, you are to make the necessary changes so that you can make to do what is right. And so my hope is that, with COVID-19 having us all sheltering in place, we're all kind of having these like existential conversations of like, oh, you know, what should I be doing with my life? You know, am I really happy here? And, you know, what have you invested in too much, or what have you not invested enough in? But it's given us a lot of time to think. So we're all sitting here with social media being our like main vehicle for connection and for insight. So I think there are more voices being amplified because of what's going on in the world, and we're dealing with a pandemic that I hope it is loud enough to disturb the sleep that many white people have been in, and to get them, you know, as the term woke, so that they can awaken from the slumber of their privilege and actually, you know, put their boots to the ground and start making some changes.
Mm, exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself. Farah, thank you very much. I'm going to have to bring the show to an end now. But before I do, I just would like you guys to share, if there's anything you want to share in terms of words of wisdom to close the show. Marcia.
Yes, there's one sentence that I think I hope will help. At this time, in order to keep the momentum, I want to use a word that Farah used, discomfort. White people have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable in order to learn and grow and move in their understanding of what racism is and how it impacts Black people and people of colour. And that's the way that we're going to move forward. More comfort with discomfort.
Powerful. Amen. Really powerful, Marcia. Really powerful. I love it. Marcia, anything you want to add? Any words of wisdom? Not Marcia, sorry, Farah.
I don't know if I can top that. I believe that.
You inspired me, Farah. You inspired me. It was fun.
No, because that is actually a term that I use, and it goes both ways. So I guess I do have something to add. So we want our white peers to get comfortable in the discomfort. And to my Black brothers and sisters, learn to be comfortable in their discomfort as we set our emotional and mental boundaries. Because so often we are bending ourselves and compromising ourselves to make them comfortable, you know, and we don't have time, obviously, because it's the end of the show, to talk about like how we would code switch or, you know, put on the happy face. But, you know, if we just show up authentically as who we are and they're uncomfortable with it, that's okay. So for our white peers, get comfortable being uncomfortable. And for my Black peers, get comfortable with their discomfort.
Yeah, yeah. It's so interesting, and it's kind of inbred sometimes to be silent as a Black person in these circumstances for fear of saying anything wrong. And I think for the white peers, I would say, stop, listen, have empathy first before you act, you know? And that's what I can add to it, along with the discomfort. I love it, Marsha. I love it, Farah. Gosh, wow. You know, I think my heart's going really fast, actually, as I'm just doing this podcast just towards the end here, because there's so much more that I want to say, but I'm going to have to bring it to a close. But this discussion is really powerful, and I really want to thank you both for taking the time out and coming on this show and being here with me in unity and speaking out about racism. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to say, from Tanya, Farah, and Marsha, as I always say at the end of the show, adios. This podcast has been so powerful today. And for anybody who's listened to the whole thing, thank you. In terms of moving forward, I think it was really powerful. I'm going to take this quote from Marsha: get comfortable with being uncomfortable and having those conversations with your Black colleagues to push forward. Thank you for listening.